Blog Talk Radio.
Well, Blog Talk listeners, it's Sunday, December 8th here in Boston, and you're getting live play. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. The Patriots have just recovered the ball with a minute or so left down in the Browns territory. They're coming back. First time they've recovered an onside kick. Oh, my. Well, we got a barn burner here, folks. We got a barn burner. And I'm waiting. I'm waiting for Brian. Here he should be there. There he is. Okay. No, we haven't got Brian yet. I don't blame him. I wouldn't call in with this insanity. Oh, boy, oh, boy. Well, it's Chris getting down the toward Christmas here. Patriots have had an amazing, amazing season. And this logo looked like it was long gone. So, hey, why don't we just excuse my excitement. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. The magic of the Patriots. My father calling in. You know, what happened? I shut it off. You know,
he's going to hurt himself. He's laughing so much. That's not me. He's some stitches up there. He's going to be sick over it.
Well, if all I got to do now is win.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God.
Oh, look at the poor bastard. Hey, look at that. That's a shame. I'm going to hang up with the rest of
you. Okay, I'll talk to you. That was my dad. That was my dad. And he is such a pessimist about ball and doesn't like Belichick, and thinks every single sporting event is an absolute fix. we think we've kind of cured him of that. But I'm just going to do a little more play-by. 1 minute left. Patriots on. It's confirmed. Patriots have the ball. What drama. Anybody with cardiac problems. Oh, my God. If they win this, it's going to be insane in Boston. Oh, boy, oh, boy. Well, here's Brian. Let's bring him in here. Hey, Brian, are you there?
I am right here. How are you doing?
I hope you're in front of a TV.
I'm sitting actually in front of a computer screen right now watching the GameCast. So.
Oh, boy. I'm, there it is. There it is, first down. Okay, well, this is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, if they do this, we're looking at another major crazy milestone in Boston sports history. Oh, here it goes. There's the launch. Oh, almost. And it's flag. Woo-hoo! Are you getting a live stream?
No, I'm just sitting in front of like a what just happened?
Pass interference. Total pass interference all over them. And so now they're going to give them what? Right down to the... Oh, how sweet. How sweet. This is the first time the listeners are going to get a play-by-play. I'm so glad we're recording this because want to re-listen to myself a couple of years from now over this one. 35 seconds left. They're on like, let me see, he was right in the end zone. So I think when they give him half the penalty, half the distance. Yeah. Yeah, he was. If he hadn't been holding him, Boyd would have caught the ball. He's oh my God, it's so egregious. So let's see here. We're down. They got, oh my God, they're like at the 3 yard line. Unbelievable. First and goal on the 3 yard line with 35 seconds left. Just all I got to do is go over and the game's over. What? Oh, my God. Are you a fan of most sports or just basketball?
Oh, no, I'm absolutely a sports fan for the Patriots, for
sure. Oh, my God.
I'm not like a diehard fan, but I definitely check the scores every weekend, for sure.
Yeah, what about being a fan in Boston?
I mean, the past 10 years has been pretty remarkable for every sport in Boston, so it's definitely been
unbelievable. Title town.
Yeah,
absolute title town. Well, they're right down with about 3 yards when they got four chances to do it. So let's see what happens here. Brady is just an absolute, you know, with your playing sports, I mean, do you admire his leadership abilities?
Oh, he is, you know, just in terms of leadership and in terms of what I like about him most is that, you know, he really uses his past experience.
They won. They won. They won. It was impossible. They won. Oh, my God. This is like, can you watch a freaking town? Oh, my goodness. I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but it is absolutely incredible. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. You're saying about his leadership ability.
No, this it is pretty amazing. I just saw that. But I think what's amazing, at least for me, watching him and seeing how he plays, especially when he's down, I mean, it's he really uses his past experiences to know that anything's possible in a game. You know what I mean? And I think just his ability to do that translates into the other players in this team. And, I mean, the guy's he has ice in his veins. You know, he's kind of like Montana when I was a kid. You know what I mean? He just has absolute ice in his veins. And it's truly amazing to watch him.
Yeah, you know, I mean, as somebody who, I mean, I don't know when you started studying Eastern religions, I mean, or what even brought you to that point. And we want to get to the movie as soon as we can here. But, I mean, Eastern religions are all about mastery.
Yes, yes. I would say, I think Western religion is about mastery too, but I would say the Western version is more about external and mental processes versus the physical. And I think that you find, you know, and that's not entirely true because I think in Greece, you know, pre-Christianity, there was a very much correlation between physical mastery and spiritual mastery, you could say, if you want to use that word. But I think, you know, for instance, Hatha Yoga is a process of gaining control over the, you know, autonomic nervous system and just this idea that anything that can be brought to awareness can be mastered. And I think we've lost that definitely in the Western traditions of sport and you know, the interaction of the physical, you know. And I think that in the East, you know, you see the martial arts, you see it certainly in yoga, the various yogas, that there is a direct connection between master the body, master the mind, where I think in the West it's more of there is master of the mind, but it's much more so of mastery over nature. It's mastery over the external environment, more so of the internal and the processes of the body that you find in India.
Absolutely. There's, you know, that's the first thing that I had studied Western religions and Western philosophy. And it was only by a crazy, just a random dialing through AM or FM radio, I forget what it was at the time, and I found Alan Watts. And it was the first time he started off. I'll never forget the first words that I heard. He says, "Who do you think you are?" And I'm listening like, who's this guy? This great British accent.
Yeah.
And who do you think you are? You know, he says, where do you begin and where do you end? And I'm like, what's he talking about? He says, do you end at your fingertips? He says, where do you end? And I'm like, you know, still going with it. And then he says, let me ask you a question. He says, how long could you exist without water? You know, and if the sun decided to drop from the sky, you know, and shine no more, how long would you exist? And, you know, all of a sudden it hit me, you know, this, I mean, because he's just speaking truth. And then his whole thing is he was totally independent with nature and obviously totally interdependent with spirit as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
he was a fascinating character. He actually lived and taught at a place where I lived myself, the Esalen Institute out in Big Sur. And there's a room named after him. And, you know, he was definitely one of the great Zen, you know, that was the tradition he was part of, but he was definitely one of the great Zen masters, both in practice and intellectually. But, you know, to be honest with you, Watts had a lot of problems himself. He was a severe alcoholic, and you know, so it is interesting how even great teachers like Watts, and he was one of the great teachers, they're also suspect to, you know, just regular human, you know, follies, you could say. You know what I mean?
Well, that was
so
what I thought.
I always, you know, his videos are on YouTube, and they're really amazing. You know, the lectures, he had such a powerful presence and a beautiful voice, like you mentioned. He had a very unique voice, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And he spoke like a poet, you know, even if with the most mundane of things. And that's one of the things that I loved about him is he says, you know, you go to study with the holy man, and after years of studying with the holy man, you wake up one day and you're in India, and you find out that the holy man has had a girlfriend.
Yeah.
And he says, and you're shocked. And he says, when you really have no reason to be shocked, you know?
Yeah.
And this is getting interesting. We've got 8 seconds, and they're down about the 40. Oh, wait a minute. It's going down to 3, 2, 1. Oh, they spiked it. Oh, boy, here we go. We got a potential field goal. Oh, boy. So we thought it was over. Who knows? Well, I'll tell you, if the Browns win it, they deserve it. Incredible. So, you know, and what kind? Let's bring it back to the movie. What did you see in terms of the mastery that was certainly on the, you know? And I want to get this point in. Americans think, oh, you get a master's degree after 4 years of college and 2 years of postgraduate, you know, a master. You know, and everybody who knows anything, you know, talks about mastery takes, you know, decades of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And no good. Oh my God, they won. Oh my God, talk about drama. There you go. And there's Belichick acting like, of course. Amazing. So what did you see in your? I mean, these kids. When would they start playing ball? In 3, 4, 5.
You know, I mean, I'm imagining probably the same as, you know, I think basketball, you start playing, well, you start fooling with the ball when you're real little. And, you know, I think maybe first grade, you're at the age where you maybe get it up to a 10-foot hoop, second grade. But I think that's like the kind of the standard age when kids start playing basketball. But that's just a guess, though. You know, I'm not entirely sure, but I would think that, you know, fooling around with the ball and then start playing some organized basketball by, you know, second, third grade.
Right, and I think that, you know, one of the things you talked about, you played right through the winter, and that's the deal, is that it's that constant attention to the sport and keeping your focus, you know, going one day at a time, every single day, and honing that. And, you know, I didn't become a magician until late in my life, and Doug Henning was big at the time, and so was David Copperfield. And Doug Henning had this great expression, and I think this will apply to your film. He would say that the impossible becomes difficult, and the difficult becomes routine, and the routine becomes easy, and the easy becomes beautiful. You know, I totally found that through the process, and you probably felt the same way, that after a while that all of the essential things like dribbling and, you know, passing and all became automatic.
Yeah, I think that's what it is, too. And I think that would be, you know, magic or basketball or playing chess or anything at all. The more you do it, the conscious processes, the things you think about, become unconscious. Or they
become,
whatever
right.
language you want to use, or they become super conscious, whatever the direction you want to go. But the bottom line is they become automatic processes where you're not thinking about it. You're in a kind of a flow, and the kind of like the repetition that you practice so many times to develop, you know, the neuromuscular coordination, the interaction of your visual field and various other processes of the body and the mind-body complex, they don't become conscious like, okay, now I'm dribbling with my left hand. They become automatic. They become, you know, unconscious.
Exactly.
Or super conscious, whatever word you want to use. But they don't become part of, and I think any great artist or any great athlete or any great, you know, and even, you know, for me myself, you know, I mean, as I make this first film, I mean, this is, you know, I'm going to be directing hopefully a lot of films in my life, and you know, this is what I want to do. So I find myself constantly reading, constantly in front of the computer, constantly fooling around with the camera, just trying to really catch up on, you know, I'm in my early 30s now, so I'm trying to catch up here. So, you know, there's that Gladwell rule. I know we talked about Gladwell last time. You know, once you do 10,000 hours of something, you become,
right,
you know, a master, so to speak, or highly proficient in it. And, you know, that's kind of where I'm going with this in terms of what I do, what I want to do with filmmaking and art. But yeah, in terms of the guys from Mission Hill, I mean, they didn't really have anything else. You know what I mean? By the early 70s, by the mid-70s, Mission Hill had become essentially a third world country. It had become a war zone, totally isolated from the city of Boston and certainly from, you know, suburban life, that's for sure. And I think basketball became, as a result of that, you know, and I think basketball came there for a few reasons. Number one, like we said last time, because of the economic reason, the basketball is by far the cheapest sport that anyone can play. Number two would be just the ability, like the self-organizational principles of basketball. You can shoot outside by yourself. You can go inside in the wintertime. You can play 2-on-2, 3-on-3. It just allows. And I think the other thing, too, which I haven't heard anyone – this was my own kind of analysis, is that basketball allows for more injection of creativity than other sports. The only other sport I would compare it to would be soccer, but certainly certainly the creativity in basketball is way higher than something like baseball or football or the more regimented sports, the more equipment
right.
you need.
I think it exists in hockey as well because – you know,
when you think
of somebody like Gretzky, you know, it
I
doesn't happen all the time, but when you get, that master comes along every once in a while,
absolutely.
It does things that nobody ever saw before, you know.
Yeah, and there's like that in baseball, too, but I would say basketball is a much easier sport to play than hockey.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? It doesn't have that. You can't, I mean, I guess you technically could go outside and just kind of fool around with a stick and a ball, but even that, you're not
right.
ice, you're not with a puck. So, I mean, there's basketball does have advantages.
You're right. It's very expensive. You only get the limited ice time, et cetera.
Exactly.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I want to talk about, you made a great point. It had slipped my mind. My master's degree came in economics, and I was right at the time. I was studying in the late 60s, early 70s. And you're absolutely right. I forgot about that. That my focus was, my major within economics was economic development. I was always obsessed with, you know, with poverty. I mean, living in a poor place, seeing poverty, you know, all my life. You know, we were relatively rich. The other kids around their families didn't have cars or whatever. We had bicycles, things like that, and we always ate. And, you know, other people, if the only times they would eat was when some charity would deliver food to the
mm-hmm.
door.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always drawn to a mission in life at that point to overcome economic deprivation. And
mm-hmm.
I remember coming out of school and still not having an idea of where and what I was going to use with. So a good friend of mine set me up with a bunch of interviews with not only economists at Harvard, but also a lot of guys from the business school. And I remember one, this is a great this is a great input to this conversation. I get in one of this really sharp, I'll never forget him, and he was so great to have taken time out of his life to steer a young guy trying to get some direction. And I said, I'm kind of confused as where to go and what to do with this. And he looked at me, and it was the best advice. I mean, it's never changed from what he said that day. He says, do what you like. And, you know, for the first time in my life, I had never heard anyone ever say that before, because it was always go get this job or go get that job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I asked him, I said, so I really do want to apply what I've learned. And I said, but I'd like to do it more in the inner city. And I said, what do you think about developing the inner city? He said, give people cars. Give them cars and give them jobs. He says, there's the answer. Yeah. You don't have to start pumping all kinds of infrastructure into the inner city to get people to do it. And it just made so, it was so simple that it was brilliant.
Well, but, you know, it's funny. You just said something really interesting, too, because I think that advice of what the, you know, for my generation, for someone to say do what you like, that's what we have always heard. You know what I mean? We've never heard anything else. Where your generation, you didn't hear that. You said go get a job, get the house. You know, so I think that mindset has a lot to do with what happened in Mission Hill, because part of the reason why the city emptied out in the 60s and the 70s was for that exact reason. You know, people didn't think do what you like. They thought go get the house in the suburbs and move out. And when that mindset was such a dominant way of viewing the world, right? Which, I mean, you know, your parents were in the Depression, and that's kind of what they instilled in you guys. And then you guys instilled in us, the next generation, different values, you know? But I think that that the turnaround of the city, which we are in the process of, you know, it's basically happened, but it's going to happen at a much more acute level. This concept of do what you like, do, you know, follow your you know, kind of like this. And it's really, to me, like a banality of, you know, the Joseph Campbell line, follow your bliss, which is kind of widespread. Because, you know, people do that, but they end up working in these kind of big corporate jobs, and it's disastrous in many ways for finding some kind of authentic life and living some kind of, you know, purpose. But it is interesting about the development of the city, because when you look at, you know, you grew up in Roxbury in Dudley Square, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so when you look at that situation, I mean, your family probably couldn't, you know, based upon the economic conditions that you guys lived in, even with inflation to where it is today, you guys would have a very hard time living in the city. You know what I mean? It's a total reversal of what it was. You know, the city was a place for poor people, for working people, for people who didn't have the resources to move outward. And now you're finding the exact opposite. You're finding the center of the city is the ultimate point of privilege, and the inner city has moved to concentric rings surrounding, let's say, Boston. You know, and what you're going to find in 30 or 40 years, ghettos will be set up around Boston, and places like Roxbury and places like even places like Dorchester will be very exclusive neighborhoods. This is going to take a little while, because even Dorchester now has some rough parts. But, you know, I would say in 30 years, 40 years, the whole city, right, and even like the closest parts of the city will be points of privilege, will be points of exclusivity, and you'll find on the outskirts, you'll find ghettos, essentially, you know, suburban ghettos. And this is, we're in the early stages of this. We really haven't seen that develop to the full. But this is precisely why a place like Mission Hill, basketball really doesn't exist there anymore. There's no longer the basketball culture that produced so many great players back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. You know, it's not necessarily because there aren't good basketball players. It's because the cultural and social conditions and economic conditions are drastically different. So,
wow. Do you make this point in the movie?
You
must make this point in the movie, right?
Yeah, towards the end, we get into the current conditions of Mission Hill. But, I mean, if I were, let's say, Rick Pitino, or if I were John Calipari, or if I were Mike Krzyzewski, I mean, I would be creating a whole new recruiting model, you know, because the recruiting model a lot of the times, and even now, I mean, you find this kind of trailing off. I mean, you know, you look at McDonald's All-Americans, and I actually ran these statistics. You look at McDonald's All-Americans in the 1980s and 90s, the overwhelming majority, and when I say McDonald's All-Americans, I'm talking about the best players in the country high school, were city kids. City kids. They were from New York City. They were from Philadelphia.
Right.
They were from Boston. They were from Chicago. They were from L.A. I mean, you look at now, I mean, you're talking about kids from, like, rural Texas, Tennessee, Kentucky. I mean, places that were the minority in the 70s. I mean, you might get a great kid from, you know, Texas or, you know, whatever. You know, it was mostly city kids, where now it's the exact opposite. I think there was one kid from New York City in the McDonald's All-American game last year, which is amazing. I mean, amazing. Think about it, you know. And this is a reflection not of basketball. This has nothing to do with basketball talent. This has to do with the socioeconomic conditions that the American city is now going through. And I think that, to me, is problematic for numerous reasons. Number one, because I'm a basketball fan. But I think even much on a much deeper level than that, because it's changing what the city has traditionally meant for people, and it's changing. And, you know, it doesn't change. I mean, you know, poor people are poor people, you know, and first we threw them into the middle of the city, left them there, and now we're pushing them out to the edge, which may in fact be worse, because at least when they were in the middle of the city, they had public transportation, they had hospitals, they had schools, you know what I mean? So now you push them out 30 miles from the city, and what do they have now? They have nothing, you know what I mean? So I think that the techniques of capital, the techniques of discrimination, the techniques of alienation are way more advanced now in 2013 with, you know, an electronic economy and how we operate as humans than they were in the 60s and 70s, you know? So I think that, and also, too, I would say, if I was to give a broader analysis of the whole situation, that the violence, you know, because everyone now is, like, drugged up on Prozac or Valium, or so you don't see, like, the outward violence that you saw growing up in the cities, you know what I mean? Because everyone's on
point. That's a fabulous point. Amazing. Go ahead.
Well, it's true. So you see a much more internal violence, where people are at war with themselves versus the external violence that you would have seen in the 1950s and 60s in ghettos. So it's just a very different – the whole situation is dramatically different, and I think that there hasn't really been leadership at all to really figure out what the hell is going to happen. So I hope people see this film to make some light bulbs go off in people's head about – what's really happening, you know? And I certainly don't claim to have all the answers, not even close. I think I'm just putting some information out there in a certain aesthetic and a certain way, and if it resonates with people, it does, and if it doesn't, it doesn't, you know?
But without a doubt, you are bringing – I mean, the thing that I'm hearing in my head, you know, that's just won't stop is book, 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 book. But, you know, you and I both – I feel anyway, I'm not going to speak for you, but I – is somebody who, you know, is so disappointed in what commercial TV did, and I think that's one of the amazing transitions. Talk about disruptive! What by the ability to put in everybody's hand, and I tell this to the inner city kids when I talk to them in schools. In your hand is one of the most powerful cameras that ever existed in all of history, and so. Now everybody has the ability, maybe not professionally, it won't look like a professional job, but everybody has the ability to voice, to record the world as they see it and to record their opinions and their thoughts and send them out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've changed, and I'm a big reader, but I see...
I mean, I don't know if I agree with that entirely. I mean, I do in one sense that we do have the technological capacity now as individuals that we didn't. But I would also say there's a big downside to that, and that the systems that these videos are uploaded to, and the spaces where this communication happens between individual people is controlled by the biggest, you know, the largest. I mean, we are. I mean, there is definitely a good side to social media, and there is definitely a good side to the fact that we can communicate with each other.
But I would also say that these communications are running across lines that are controlled by the most powerful corporations in the world. You know what I'm saying? So I don't think for a second that, like, real change, if that's what we want, is going to happen over, let's say, a Twitter or Facebook type feed. You know what I'm saying? Because I just don't entirely buy that. But I do agree, though, that when we have the capacity to, you know, take pictures and upload, I mean, there is definitely, obviously, something very powerful to that and very good to that. But I also think that there's a big, huge blind spot or dark side that a lot of people don't quite see, in that the space that we're using to share this information is being 100% monitored, and it's being downloaded, and it's being tracked. I mean, you know, you saw the whole NSA thing. I mean, they have all this information. Is not like, it's not our information. You know what I'm saying? This is being stored on the cloud, and, like, you know, so which I mean, you know, a part of me really doesn't care. You know, I mean, you know, you can have access to my stuff, whatever, but a part of me does, because I think it just violates, you know, what a free society is actually all about. You know what I mean? So that's kind of the one caveat that I would make to that statement that you just gave, not to interrupt you or anything like that. But,
well, I know. I totally agree. That's the Achilles heel to all of this, is that,
yeah.
And you know, that's one of the reasons that I have my own blog, because I know too well some of the things I've posted on Facebook disappear.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
And
well,
then
I mean,
it's totally arbitrary what they decide to cut.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm totally, and you're right. Once they decide, you know, they make it very clear that anything you upload is their property.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even
yeah.
have a copyright on it if you put it mm-hmm. up there first.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah.
I totally see the Achilles heel, and I think, but, you know, I kind of see it as an interdependent thing, that where would they be if there wasn't content? You know?
Yeah,
I mean,
no, it's, you know, I mean, this, you know, to create the infrastructure to have that kind of space and storage where you can store, you know, a million of your own pictures on Facebook, this is incredibly expensive. So, you know, you look how, let's say, Facebook has capitalized the billions of dollars that are invested in the company that really doesn't make that much money. You know what I mean? It's not like Facebook
right.
is like profitable here, you know? They're investing because the economy that we're in the process of dramatically changing. You know, we are moving into like a virtual economy, a hyper-real economy, where that information one day will be worth a lot of money, you know?
Oh,
because
absolutely. And also,
yeah.
Right, and the fact that so many people, they know, you know, that by giving it away, now is leading, you know, is, if you read, I think I recommended Vanderchuk's book to you, Crush It. I mean, the dollars, the advertising dollars are going to go where the eyes go.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right, there's billions of dollars to be made in all of this, and that's why, you know, the geniuses that created this stuff, you know, saw and felt that. And so
yeah.
I totally agree, but, you know, here, look at what the ability of this communication to topple, you know, it is a double-edged sword. This communication to date has toppled whole political systems. I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
look at in Egypt and all of these other places.
But I mean, even Egypt, though, it did, but it really didn't, because a far more autocratic and kind of like horrible government was put in place. You know what I mean? So, like,
right.
we as Americans don't even like it. That to me was like such a funny thing, in that we were like extolling Twitter as being like the savior of humanity, but we didn't realize that, you know, after Hosni Mubarak left, a worse guy came in. You mean a worse
oh, yeah.
guy
well,
came in? So what did Twitter do for that? So, I mean, I think there are
yep.
limitations to what this kind of technology could do. But to tie it back into Mission Hill, I mean, you know, it would have been great. I mean, none of these people at Mission Hill even had money to have video cameras. You know, I mean, back in the 70s and 80s. So there's like no footage at all of, like, you know, I have a lot of old footage that I've been able to get my hands on. But in terms of just like street ball pickup games, there's none. You know what I mean? If I was making this film 20 years from now about the basketball culture today, I'd have a plethora of information
oh,
just based upon
absolutely.
The advancing technological capacity of a person. But, I mean, you know, if you were in Mission Hill in 1980, you didn't have food. You didn't, never mind a video camera. You know what
exactly.
I mean? So
exactly.
That,
exactly.
That's a perfect example of how technology is improving. You know what I mean? It is making life better. But we also have to be aware of, the downside to that. But I think in terms of Mission Hill, a lot of these things are interrelated. You know, technology, the city, and even basketball comes into place, and how our society is being structured now. You know, we talked about last week about how, you know, childhood life is so organized and administered and you know, hyper-organized, I would say. And I think in Mission Hill, even though there was some organization to the basketball culture, it really wasn't. I mean, there was a, I mean, they used to use milk crates for basketball hoops. They used to put them on the brick buildings, and they used to play, you know, on grass, you know what I mean, like all day long, 10 hours a day in the summertime, you know what I mean? So, I mean, there's some amazing stories of how these kids back in the 70s, 80s, and even 90s. I mean, let's face it. I mean, Mission Hill in the mid-90s was maybe the worst it's ever been. You know, I mean, I think the city kind of hit a down point in the mid-90s, and it kind of been moving upward ever since then. But, I mean, you know, I was in high school in the mid to late 90s. And when I was in high school in Boston, you didn't go into Roxbury. I mean, you didn't go into Boston. I mean, that was a scary place. And now, you know, I walk along Parker Street in Mission Hill. I mean, all I see is young college girls walking around, young college kids walking around. I don't see any type of – you would never walk on Parker Street in Mission Hill in 2013 and ever think that there's danger lurking or there ever was danger lurking. You would walk along Parker Street and see college kids. You know, you would
exactly.
Walk around – And see kids in Northeastern or Wentworth or, you know, even, you know, Harvard, if you get your master's at Harvard at Public Health is right on Huntington Avenue. So you would see people like that. You really, you know, you might see a couple people from the projects, you know, because, I mean, basically one half of the projects now, when you look at Mission Hill, it was always there was two sides to the project. There was Mission Maine, which was essentially the first project that was built in 1941, which is behind the church. If you're coming from Parker on Tremont, it's the
right,
left side
right.
of Parker Street. And the right side would be the extension. That was built in 1952, I think. And
mm-hmm.
those structures are still there. Those are still like bricks, you know what I mean? But the whole original side of Mission Hill, Mission Main, I mean, it's like townhouses, you know? And there are still a lot of low-income people. There are still some low-income people that live there. But, I mean, college kids live there now. I mean, you know, it's ironic that you have, like, college kids living in the projects, you know what I mean? Whereas over on the other side, in the extension, on the right side of Parker Street, you don't see that as much. It's still mostly low-income people. But, I mean, that's changing as well. I mean, the whole dynamic of the neighborhood is really changing quickly. And when you look at the history of Mission Hill in 41, when Mission Maine was built, it was like almost 99% like, you know, white Irish, maybe some Italian, mostly Irish, but some Italian families, Polish families. But it was working families, you know, firemen, police officers, worked for the Edison, worked for the state, whatever. And Mission Extension, when it was built in 1952, was kind of almost from its inception an integrated project. And then by the early 60s, it became an all-black project. So you basically had... In the mid-60s in Mission Hill, Mission Maine, all white, Parker Street separated, then you had Mission Extension, all black, and basically all those white families just started, you know, getting out of there, and by, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, it was like, you know, 99% black in both projects, you know, so that's really, and that also, too, I think, is very different in Boston. I mean, you don't really see those strong ethnic neighborhoods, those dividing lines. I mean, North End, take North End for an example. I mean, you know, no Italian people live in the North End anymore. I mean,
nope.
You know, they have the stores along Hanover Street, but I mean, North End's a totally gentrified yuppie neighborhood. And I think it's really when you look at Mission Hill and the basketball story, it really mirrors the other neighborhoods in Boston, South Boston, Charlestown, North
yep.
End of kind of what happened there as well. It's very
yep.
similar in many ways, you know.
Yep. Absolutely. It's, it's the gentrification process. It's, you know, it's night and day, because I lived there. I not only knew Roxbury, but of course, because I traveled in Dudley Street and Mission, but I knew Jamaica Plain and I knew the South
yeah.
End and I knew South Boston and it was endless that it was just, you're right, low income, all of the entire inner city was low income. Beacon mm-hmm. Hill was like the only place
yeah.
where that wasn't true.
Yep.
And,
yep,
you know, and maybe West Roxbury, you know, there were certain places, but for the most part, that
West,
was the
West
story.
Roxbury was kind of like more like upper middle class, but it was never like wealthy. It was kind of like a,
right, exactly.
like, you know, like, yeah, lace curtain Irish, as they say.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I think, I want to give a new label. I mean, you call this a documentary, but I suppose a lot of documentaries will give maybe more than just in an analysis. But it seems to me what you're doing is not only recording, you're not only documenting what happened and everything else, but you're giving an analysis that gives a thought provoking. And that's the only term I can come up with right now, because some of the concepts you just came up with make people think. And do you emphasize those in the film?
Yeah, definitely. I think that there's definitely the bookends of the film, the beginning and the end, don't have really anything to do with basketball, really. I mean, a little bit. But the beginning of the film is kind of like a history on public housing in Boston, Mission Hill specifically. How that happened, like how, you know, just the building of it, how it was, what it was like culturally and socially when it was first built. And then it gets into, you know, this massive movement of the black families from the South into Boston in the 50s and 60s that ended up coming to places like Mission Hill, you know, like the Turner family, their parents, you know, the mother's side was from Virginia, the father's side from Alabama, and how, you know, they ended up settling in places like Mission Hill. And then the middle part of the film deals with the development of the basketball culture and the Turner brothers as kind of case studies as representations of the basketball culture. And the end of the film deals with more about the current state of Mission Hill and kind of, you know, gentrification and what's happening there now and how sadly, you know, the pride that the basketball gave that neighborhood is kind of not there anymore. And it's, so it is a commentary not only about Mission Hill, but also about, you know, the city in general, and not just Boston. I mean, I think this is applicable to, you know, the city itself, you know, what the city means in America. I mean, you know, even Manhattan in the 60s and 70s, this is a place where, like, you know, artists would go there and live in cockroach-infested apartments and try to make it, you know what I mean? You can't do
right.
that now in Manhattan. You know what I mean? You get to pay $3,000 a month for a studio in Manhattan, you know?
Right.
So I think
right.
that... and even Brooklyn, I mean, you know, Williamsburg is like kind of like the new Left Bank. I mean, you know, you can't even get an apartment there. So maybe Bronx or the Queens will end up being like the next kind of haven for artists that want to make it in New York. But, you know, it's just a totally different, the meaning of the city, what the city has traditionally meant for people is in a process of major change, you know, it's
Go
not
ahead.
For the better. It's for the worse.
No, I totally agree because not before there was a sense of neighborhood, sense of community. That is gone. That is dead.
Yeah.
That is over. That there is no sense. You know, I you know, cynically call South Boston an outside gym.
Mm-hmm.
It's an outside gym. There's nothing
mm-hmm.
but young people running all the time. And, you know, in the summertime, they're running in what looks like, you know, what would be the inside of a fighter's gym, you know.
Yeah.
And there's nothing attractive. Everything is totally monosyllabic, you know, homogeneous. There's no individuality. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like the expression that existed in the 60s.
That's one of the things, too. I think there's a bigger message, of at least for me, in what gentrification really is. I mean, you know, when you look at, you know, let's say take this city for an example. Let's just take Boston for an example. When you look at what a local community is, what a local neighborhood is, I mean, they, in addition to being part of a city, they also have their own local culture and local community and local customs and local whatever, you know what I mean? And 30 years ago, I mean, the North End, South Boston, I mean, these are very different places. You know what I mean? Even though they were a mile apart, they had their own specific culture. And I think that any time a local community has its own culture, it's very antagonistic to, you know, corporate influence. You know what I mean? Because they root in the community. They stay there for it's like a generational thing. And they have their own businesses and their own kind of, you know, their own economies of scale, so on and so forth. And, you
right.
know,
You see this in the South when, like, Walmart shows up to a small town in the South. It just devastates the whole
totally.
The whole town. Like,
listen, they're gonna shut us off, and it's gonna be an abrupt shut off. Like, we've got about, I don't know, like, they don't even show me the time after a little
okay.
while. So can we do another one? These are great.
Yeah, we can do another one. That sounds good.
Okay, thank you so much, Brian. Before they shut us off, and like I say, I hate even to